So at this halfway stage of the retreat, and I'm really wanting to offer appreciation and encouragement. It's a very moving thing, actually, to be with you all in the groups and one-to-ones, and to have the privilege, really, of to hear what's happening in your lives, and so many different things happening for different people, and really just wanting to appreciate and acknowledge the care that I see being brought to all the different challenges that come up in life. So I feel that's part of my role here as teacher, you know, like the coach saying, well done, you're halfway through, keep going, you're doing well. So, it's nice to play that role. I just feel like that makes me smile. And this evening I wanted to share some thoughts about how mindfulness sheds light on how distress is created in our lives, particularly the additional extra suffering, not the inevitable pains of life, but the additional extra suffering we can experience. How it's created, so how mindfulness can really help us to see the patterns, the processes that create distress. And also then the patterns and processes whereby we can release that distress. So this is absolutely at the heart of what our practice is all about, really. Suffering and the end of suffering is what the Buddha said that he taught. We're really looking into, now, how is suffering created, and how do we find freedom? And I wanted to start by offering just a couple of very everyday examples, which I find helpful to ground what I'll be talking about. So the first one comes from a psychology textbook I came across some years ago. I was talking about a person who arranged to see his friend for lunch. And so he's waiting in the cafe for his friend to come. You know, 10 minutes go by, 20 minutes go by, half an hour goes by, and there's no sign of the friend. And then, you know, finally he sort of maybe has some food and goes, but no sign of the friend at all. When he hears from the friend later, to say, oh, I'm so sorry, I completely forgot, I've been overwhelmed at work and I'd really like to see you. This person is so locked in a particular way of perceiving this that in the end the friendship ends. So he's so locked into the idea, this was disrespectful, this was so rude, how dare this person treat me like this, I never want to see them again. Kind of thing. Yeah. Now, for me, when I read that, I've thought about it a lot, actually, since. Because it strikes me as very, very poignant, that kind of story. Because if you imagine that a person deals with difficulty in that way, if you were to make the assumption that that was a habitual way they dealt with difficulty, and that that played out over a lifetime, then we can really see the huge distress that would cause for them and for other people. You know, very difficult, isn't it, to maintain friendships if you the response to a difficulty is like that. And you could imagine also that that would flow out into how things were at work, maybe in other parts of life too. The other reason I find it poignant is that I don't know if this is revealing too much, but I can kind of see that also, that tendency, that pattern in my own mind. I may not do exactly that, but I can see that point when my mind moves into that place. and I can see it in other people too. So I don't think, oh, there's this poor, this poor person who responded in that way, you know, how sad for them. Actually, I hear something in that story of a more universal place that our minds can go to in the face of stress and difficulty. So it feels to me really worth considering what's happening in that kind of situation. A second situation, just to mention, which some of you may be incredibly familiar with, is that you're walking down the street. Yeah, so for some people know this is like the greatest hits. If that's not, if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's like going to see your concert and somebody sings the first line and everybody joins in. But anyway, you're walking down the street and you see a friend on the other side and you wave at the friend and the friend doesn't respond in any way. Yeah. So if you haven't heard that before, it's a key story from MBCT. And the idea of that in MBCT is that how we feel about what's happened depends on how we think about it, depends on the interpretation. So if we think that the person has deliberately ignored us, we're likely to be very angry. If we think they were just miles away, we won't think too much about it. If we think other people on the street saw us waving and nobody responded, we might feel embarrassed. If we think maybe they're just completely overwhelmed by what's happening in their life, we may feel deeply concerned. So the idea is that, in a sense, it's a fairly blank thing that happens. All that we know is that the person didn't wave back. But how we can feel is very different depending on the interpretation that's there. Yeah? But we can continue to think about both of these examples. You know, what's happening? What's happening? Because also, as is explored later on in MBCT, you may discover, I certainly again think this is true in my experience, depending on what else is going on, I'm more or less likely to interpret that thing in different ways. Yeah. If I haven't slept very well, I'm really hungry, in a rush to get somewhere, or somebody else has just been rude to me or something, I'm more likely to interpret that in a particular way. If I'm feeling on top of the world, if I've just come off a Gaia house retreat and I'm thinking, oh, those lovely people, then I'm likely to think, oh, well, who knows what they were. Yeah. But I don't know if you notice that. You know, sometimes our minds are much more prone to get drawn to particular interpretations and perceptions, and other times it doesn't seem to be happening in the same way. So there's a teaching from the Dharma teachings called the links of dependent origination. And this teaching can shed some light on what's happening in these kind of examples. I'm going to offer a particularly psychological interpretation of this teaching. I mean, it's seen by many people as one of the most profound of Dharma teachings, and you would expect, given that there are different ways of understanding it, interpreting it, different things it can be pointing to. So I offer this as sort of one thing we can draw from this, but I hope that it encourages you to think about this teaching more and, you know, other different ways of interpreting it. But this doesn't really have a beginning, in a sense, because it's describing a kind of circular process that goes round and round. But insofar as it has a beginning, the beginning is ignorance. Yeah. Or we might even say, this, you know, a very everyday way of interpreting that is saying we're unaware, we're not being mindful, we're not seeing clearly. Yeah. So when we're in this state of ignorance, we're not aware, we're not seeing clearly, then what are called sankharas, which I'm going to interpret as habitual patterns, are operating. Okay, so if we just pause at those two for a minute. When we're unaware, when we're not mindful, then these habitual patterns are operating. So in that person in the cafe waiting for the friend, there might have been the habitual pattern that says something like, oh, people tend to let me down, people let me down, or I'm the kind of person people are rude to. Or it might be a habitual pattern to tend towards responding to disappointment with hostility. Yeah? So as we know, to more or less different degree, for some people that could be quite a strong pattern. Yeah? So these habitual patterns then shape what's called consciousness and name and form. And again, for simplicity's sake, today I'm going to take that whole thing to essentially mean our mind and body in any moment. Yeah? So our mind and body is shaped by these habitual patterns and tendencies. So you might even see that, say, on the expression on someone's face or the kind of impulses that might be there. I remember I live in Nottingham, and I remember once being in a takeaway in Nottingham. I like giving these everyday examples anyway. But this person came in. I was having my veggie burger or whatever was at home. But somebody came in, and honestly, it really was very painful. They were just ordering their food, but their habitual patterns were so to the fore that they were seeing this thing of ordering food as just some kind of fight and hostile and difficult thing. Oh, give me more of that. Why is that? Is that a bit fresh? You know, can't I have some more of that? More of this, more of that. And basically the shopkeeper, I think, just looked a bit perplexed by it because they really hadn't done anything. But this person was just coming in. And again, it's really poignant, actually. And I think the habitual pattern was life is a fight. And I remember, because I was sitting down eating my food, really starting to feel for this person. I was thinking, gosh, what's happened to you that life is experienced like that? You know, just an ordinary thing of ordering some food. It's just experience in that way. But you could see it, you know, in the gestures, facial expression, manner of speech. So when we're unaware, habitual patterns can shape our mind and body. And this is then influences the sense doors. So what we're seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling. You know, how our senses are operating. And again, you can imagine if a habitual pattern of threat is activated, then the sense doors are scouring the world to look for what's threatening and what's wrong. So all this is kind of happening in the background. Then there is contact, which means that we see, hear, taste, touch, or smell something. So in that example, the contact is the friend doesn't arrive, the sight of the chair being empty. And then there's feeling. Now feeling here is Vedana that Jenny's been talking about, pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. So these feelings then, you can imagine that person in the cafe waiting for the friend, the feeling tone is very unpleasant. Feeling tone of the sight, then going to be related body sensations, perhaps of tension, also experienced as unpleasant. Thoughts will arise that will have an unpleasant feeling tone associated with them, you know. And then this grows, basically. So the process describes feeling becoming craving, becoming clinging, feeling leading to craving, leading to clinging. And my sense of that really is like something growing. And given this kind of pattern, we could almost see it's like a weed. You know, so the weed just comes out of the ground and then it gets bigger and bigger. Okay. And so if we were to put this in everyday language, it's something like, this is unpleasant. I don't like it. I can't stand it. It shouldn't be like this. Yeah. The clinging part is when there's fuel put on the fire. So the key point here, though, to remember is that this is all come from, or we can trace it back to this sense of something being merely unpleasant. Yeah? So there's the merely unpleasant, but it starts to grow. It starts to grow as these habitual patterns kick in. And then you get to a couple of these links that sound strange at first, which are becoming and birth. And in this interpretation I'm offering, birth means something psychological. There are other ways of looking at this, by the way. just to say, but in this, the way I'm presenting it, birth is a psychological sense. So it's when we talk about selfing. And what that really means is the sense of me, in the case of this person in the cafe, the sense of him being a person who's someone let down, who's let down again, a person who's been disrespected, a person who's experiencing a sense of lack, that whole sense of who he is comes into being. Makes sense. So the idea of this teaching is that actually different senses of who I am arise at different times. And you may have noticed that again already this week. Have there been moments this week when you have been born, psychologically speaking, as the next Dalai Lama? I don't know if you have. That might be a big one, you know. Or moments of being born as the worst meditator in the world. Or, you know, moments of being born as whatever it is. But you can actually see that our sense of who we are really changes during the day. And this kind of process is describing how that comes. So it could well be that this person who is psychologically born as a furious person with a friend who hasn't arrived, an hour later was, in a sense, someone else. Yeah. And making the links, as we've been doing with MBCT, and actually with cognitive therapy more generally, you may know that Beck, the cognitive therapist, talks about the negative triad that people have when depressed. And that can be negative thoughts about the self, the world, and the future. But if you think again about the self there, yeah, so in a particular mood, in this depressed place, a particular sense of self arises. We're making a similar point. And then to complete this circle, this then goes on to aging and death, so this sense of self that's arisen eventually fades, but the whole process is characterized by sorrow, by pain, grief. So it's a painful cycle being described here. There's another Dharma teaching that really talks about the same process but from a different angle, and this comes from the Honeyball Sutta. And here you also get contact leading to feeling, so we're in the same territory as before. But rather than feeling being followed by craving, in this one it's followed by perception. So here the perception might be something like, that's rude. That's rude. Yeah. Or, in fact that probably covers it. You know, that person who's feeling that in the cafe, that's what, or the person interpreting the person not waving them back in the street. Rude. Yeah. And then out of that comes thinking, and then this phrase called the proliferation of thought, or papancha in Pali. And my sense is that this link, feeling, perception, thinking, proliferation of thought, is just another way, in a way, of talking about what we were talking about earlier, feeling, craving, clinging, becoming. It's not a totally different process, they're just different aspects of the process. But it's drawing more attention to the role of thinking. So what kind of thoughts might that person be having in the cafe? They're not here, it's 5 minutes, I wonder where they are. Starts like that, you know, then that's rude. I can't believe they've done that. All those times I've been there for them, how dare they treat me like that? And then, you know, as we may know, it could really expand. Why is it that people always treat me like this? Do you know, do you see that thing? And again, we can see it in our own minds if you pay attention, where there's that jump from the particular to the general. And it's a very painful jump. Because you've moved from the particular thing, which is difficult, friend hasn't arrived, to a much more painful thought. Why do these things always happen to me? Why am I the kind of person? Yeah. And even, of course, nothing, you know, nothing ever works out for me. Now, as I say it now, again, from a distance, we can think, well, how can that come? Nothing ever works out for me. Well, you know, actually, just your friend's not there for one time. So when we look at it sort of dispassionately from a distance, we can see, this is a, might even say it's a faulty bit of reasoning or something, which, you know, on one level it is. But it's very painful, isn't it, when we're caught in these things. And my sense, by the way, if you're thinking, gosh, he's describing how my mind works, I don't know if you are thinking that, but for me this is pretty universal. I mean, some people have this to different extents, but if you notice that time when you're really stressed, when you're overwhelmed, when the fight-flight mechanism is kicked in, this is more how we're thinking. Yeah. And you can see it too when you, on an interpersonal level, when people are in that place, that's how they argue, isn't it? When you're arguing with someone, you know, it's more like, you never do this, or you always do that. You never help me out. I don't know. I always like to find someone who had an argument where they said, I acknowledge that on many occasions you have helped me out, but on this particular occasion you didn't help me out and I was disappointed. You know, who argues like that? Maybe in a period drama or something, but apart from that. But we don't, because our minds aren't operating like that. It's more never, always. You know, it's all or nothing thinking kicked in. Yeah. So let me give you some good news. Because really so far I've been describing how that distress is created. But the good news is that mindfulness helps. it was worth coming after all. Yeah. So how does mindfulness help? Well, I'm going to offer a couple of models of this. One is actually using a contemporary paper called The Mechanisms of Mindfulness by Shapiro and colleagues. Some of you may be familiar with this. Their model is called the IAA model. But The Mechanisms of Mindfulness is basically interested in how mindfulness works. So a lot of the mindfulness research was looking at the outcomes. You know, people do a course and this measure has changed in this way. But other people said, yeah, that's good, but how? What is happening? What's the mechanism? So this is one theory. And they start by saying that mindfulness allows us to re-perceive. So this refers to a shift in perspective in which, instead of being immersed in the drama of our personal narrative or life story, we're able to stand back and simply witness it. Our practice is supporting us to do this. Instead of being immersed in the drama of our personal narrative or life story, we are able to stand back and simply witness it. Yeah. So what could be happening? Again, for the person in the cafe, they start to notice those thoughts. They notice the thought that was really rude. They notice the thought, why do these things keep happening to me? But they're much more aware of them as thoughts. Now that, again, is all the difference in the world, isn't it? You know, when we say thoughts are not facts, it's like we are putting before our thoughts the words, it seems as if. It seems as if. And some schools even teach people to say things like, I'm having the thought that. One of my most uplifting times I had teaching MBCT was teaching a person who said that she'd woken up in the morning and had the thought, you know, I've got nothing to look forward to. But then she said, and I was able to see it was just a thought. And she was saying this with a beaming smile on her face. And I really thought, this is worth doing. Because that makes all the difference, doesn't it? I have nothing to look forward to, in capital letters, in bold, definite, you know, believed, to, oh, that's a thought that's arisen. Yeah. So this is really supportive, the reperceiving. Instead of being immersed in the drama of our personal narrative or life story, we're able to stand back and simply witness it. And that supports other things that Shapiro and colleagues talk about, one of which is values clarification, the way in which mindfulness can help us to re-examine values we may have subconsciously absorbed from parents and the wider society, and to find out what is genuinely important to us as individuals. I find that really helpful. Yeah. You know, mindfulness really... yeah, supporting us to know what we really care about. And again, very practically speaking, I think this would make a difference in that moment. So the person might notice that they feel very angry with the friend who hasn't turned up for lunch, but then there might be this sense of the values. Okay, but I really value friendship. I value trying to be kind to people. And that may temper how they then speak. So acting more from values rather than from impulse. They also say that mindfulness helps us with exposure, which is developing an increased capacity to witness negative emotional states and painful physical sensations without aversion. So we're training ourselves to be more tolerant, to be able to be with even more difficult aspects of our experience. And that's a nice way of reframing also what might have been happening for you on this retreat. If there have been times when it's difficult and you're being with that and you're noticing, gosh, this is maybe a painful sensation in the body or a painful feeling, but I can be with it. And that capacity to be with those, again, opens up a space of choice, doesn't it? Because without that capacity, we tend to do something more impulsive or more reactive. We might have an unhelpful coping strategy around it, like, I don't know, drinking really heavily when we feel distressed, or always being immediately very hostile in our communication, or something else. But the capacity to hold the pain opens a space to make some different choices. And this is the last part of their paper I wanted to share, which is that they say mindfulness leads to greater emotional, cognitive and behavioral flexibility, which basically means we can think more flexibly, and that means we feel differently and we have more options in how we behave. So the person, again, if we go back to the person in the cafe for a moment, they could say, how might I deal with this? What are the different ways I could think about this? So the reperceiving means they're aware of this idea, that was really rude, I was disrespected, but there's a capacity to think differently. Maybe I don't know everything about what's going on. I wonder what was happening for the other person. Yeah. And then the capacity to behave differently. And they might say something like, again, you might have your own thoughts about what a mindful response would be in that situation. In my mind, it could be that they still say to the person, you know, I was really upset when you didn't come because I was looking forward to seeing you and it felt hard waiting there on my own. So I don't think the mindful response, again, this is always worth knowing, the mindful response is not the response that says, oh, everything's fine. You know, a person can still say, it wasn't really okay for me that you didn't turn up. But let's meet again. And what was happening for you? Oh, you were overwhelmed at work. Tell me more about that. Let's meet up for coffee and we'll catch up. Now, I don't know if this sounds like a small thing, but the difference between dealing with difficulty in that intransigent way with emotional, cognitive and behavioral inflexibility and the difference between dealing with flexibility day after day, week after week, month after month is life-changing, actually. Yeah. So also to say how we might understand this using the Dharma teachings. In the suttas, the scholars have identified four functions of mindfulness, and Jenny's mentioned some of these already. But the function of mindfulness that simply knows, you know, like when we're hearing a bird song and we're just receiving the sound of the bird, or when we're aware of the breath and we're simply aware of the breath. This simple knowing without additional kind of commentary or layering of analysis. And this is the function of mindfulness we're trained on an 8-week course on right at the beginning when we eat a raisin very slowly, a simple knowing and awareness. But as Jenny mentioned, mindfulness also has a protective function, and this idea of the gatekeeper. You remember that idea from, was it yesterday? Or, this idea of the walls around an ancient city, and what an important job that would be. So the walls are keeping people protected, and really significant, you know, who comes in, who doesn't come in, how can we keep that safe? So there you can see again that gatekeeping function in the examples I've given you. You know, walking down the street, person doesn't wave back, starts to have these thoughts, they've deliberately ignored me, I can't believe they've done that, you know, this has happened to me again. But then the gatekeeping function might kick in there and say, notices those thoughts. It's not aversive to them, it's not saying I shouldn't be having them or I'm wrong for having them. But it would definitely notice, this is not the most helpful thing to feed. This is not the most helpful thing to grow. This is not the most helpful thing to simply immediately communicate to someone. So we start to protect that. We might notice the mind going in that direction and deliberately choose to place the attention elsewhere. We might choose to feel the feet on the ground and notice what's around us. Yeah, I think as I mentioned, I really like that question, what's happening now? I find that a useful element of this protective awareness if the mind is going off into something that feels a bit unhelpful. What's happening now? And then it also has an investigative function. And the image of this is like a surgeon's probe. You could imagine if a surgeon was just exploring a wound, you know, just to very gentle, isn't it? A very delicate, gentle work just to see what's here, what needs care, what needs attention. And that our mindfulness really has this sense as well. So again, imagine how supportive that would be for that person as they wait in the cafe, just to, if it were possible to have a moment to pause and investigate. What's it like now? What's happening for me? How's the throat? How's the belly? What kind of thoughts are present? And if you know the breathing space, again, you know, opens up a space where we can notice those things. And the final function of mindfulness that's described in the suttas is a reframing perception, reframing view. And again, the possibility that there are new perspectives. There are other ways of seeing things than the fixed, intransigent way we'd fallen into. One thing I've really felt more and more over recent years is how the sense of allowing and the sense of really giving ourselves space to feel what we're feeling is a kind of precondition before we can really find new perspectives. Let me explain that a little bit more. But the sense of really feeling what we're feeling, sensing that in the body, becomes a kind of precondition before we can find different perspectives. So, if you again imagine the person, they're in the cafe and they're distressed. If they immediately try to say to themselves, oh, don't make such a big deal of this, it's not such a big thing, I think you're overreacting. My sense is that those kind of thoughts are really quite unhelpful. Yeah, the reason they're unhelpful is because in that moment we're really activated, we're really triggered. The fight-flight mechanism is there. So what we need is a sense of nurturing, soothing. This is where the N of rain comes in. So that part of ourselves needs to be really held with awareness, with kind awareness. And as it's held, it then softens. And as it softens, then there's the possibility of new perspectives. Yeah? I don't know if that makes sense. I can give you another example of it, but I don't know if you've ever done the thought forms that cognitive behavioral therapists do, where they encourage people to write down thoughts and then, you know, maybe look for alternatives. But when I was exploring these, one thing that I thought was really significant and helpful is that they also ask people to look for evidence for the thought. They don't go straight to evidence against. And this seems to me to be really skillful. So let's say if a person's having a thought, oh, people always let me down. Well, what's the evidence for that? And it gives a little bit of space to say, oh, well, I have felt let down recently. I didn't like it when my friend didn't turn up for lunch. Whatever it is, yeah? So you're giving some space to feel that. And it's only when that part of us, that more vulnerable, painful part, is heard and felt and nurtured with our awareness, that then there's the capacity to say, now let's think about it differently. Might there be another way of looking at this? Yeah. So you can see this, by the way, interpersonally as well as intrapersonally. In other words, the very processes we're exploring in meditation about how we meet our own distress, how we meet those moments when we're like the person in the cafe, there's a real parallel between that and how we meet distress in others. Again, the question sometimes arises, is all this quite selfish, what we're doing in mindfulness and how we're being with it? But this is one of many examples of where it really does benefit others. Because we start to see, yeah, what is our own pain and distress need? It needs to be held, understood, nurtured. You know, that part of us needs some soothing. And from the soothing, yes, then we can get to new perspectives, different ways of thinking. But it does need to go that way round. If the new perspectives come in too quickly, it's like we're telling ourselves, ah, you got this wrong. You know, you're overreacting, you're not thinking clearly. And what happens when someone tells you that? We've probably all had that experience. When someone tells you you're overreacting, you feel even more. Why? Because it's not being part of you is hurting, it's not being heard. So it gets louder. Whereas if you hear it, and again, same process, interpersonally and how we are in meditation. This is why we have the A in rain. Can we allow that? Can we feel that? Be curious about it gently. Nurture it. We can begin to soothe our own distress, and we can begin to find ways out of these kind of patterns and processes that I've been describing. So, yeah, it's a really helpful thing, I think, to continue for all of us to investigate and reflect on these processes whereby distress is built. You know, out of a sense of something being unpleasant, habitual patterns kicking in, how things can grow, from craving to clinging to becoming, the role of thinking in that, the proliferation of thought, or rumination, we might say. But also all the skillful ways we are learning to respond to that. Ways like rain, you know, recognizing what's here, allowing it, being curious, nurturing. Different elements of mindfulness I've described. And exploring this and really seeing it in our own experience can really serve our own well-being and also supports us to be compassionate and caring when we meet others in their distress too. So let's have a moment to pause together. And again, the encouragement not to need to remember all of the details, but maybe there's something there that stimulates something that feels significant, meaningful for you. Staying with that.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.